Hello, I'm Michael Brennan Doherty, politics editor at the Business Insider, whose offices are right behind me, and I'm here today with Adam Suhr, who will now introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Adam Suhr with Mother Jones, and it's great to be here.
Yeah, great to be here. We're in the middle of the first big week in the Republican nominating process, where votes are actually being cast, and on Tuesday night, Mitt Romney defeated the surging Rick Santorum by just 8 votes, and kept a lot of us up very late into the night looking for that last total. So I thought we'd start out and just talk about, you know, Mitt Romney, what does that 8-vote victory mean? I think the first reaction I saw was, and the first reaction I had was, oh, well, 75% of Republicans still don't like Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
And then gradually it's become, well, that doesn't matter. He's not winning Republican hearts and minds, but it looks like he's on a very good pace to win the nomination.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of, I think, structural factors that favor Romney. I mean, if you look at Santorum as a candidate, he's like down there in the bottom 4 Republican candidates in terms of money he's personally mm-hmm. raised. I mean, he has some super PAC money that helped him out in Iowa, but he's not, he hasn't raised a lot of money. He doesn't have the sort of national organization that Romney has, and he's not on the ballot in a bunch of important primary states. So I think it's hard to see how Santorum, even though he sort of, I think until the last week, people were not considering, weren't taking Santorum seriously as a candidate for winning Iowa. But he sort of, he sort of shocked everybody.
Yeah.
Leading to a lot of really juvenile come from behind headlines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, yes. And what's interesting is, and I think Eric Erickson, of all people, was the first person to make this very astute observation, which is that the reason Rick Santorum won Iowa is because he failed as a campaigner, which is that he's been doing this shoe leather thing and all of these publications are hailing him for the shoe leather campaign in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
But as Erickson pointed out, the shoe leather campaign attracted almost zero support in the polls and almost no money in the coffers.
Mm-hmm.
And the attention just sort of fell on him because he was the last place to land for non-Romney,
right,
non-Ron Paul voters. And he never raised his media profile enough to even be scrutinized. And he might have suffered under that scrutiny. Maybe he'll suffer later this week.
Yeah, I mean, I think Santorum's someone who has a tremendous amount of baggage. And I think it's sort of obscured by the fact that everyone's really obsessed with Santorum's social conservatism,
mm-hmm.
Because he's been the person who said a lot of, relatively memorable statements, man on dog sex, et cetera, et cetera. There's sort of a belief in him as this, he's just the religious conservative candidate, and there hasn't been a whole lot of attention paid to whatever, conservative heresies he might have been involved in that might diminish the enthusiasm for him the same way they did for Newt and for, every other previous non-Romney.
Right. I mean, it lends a lot of credence. One of the polls coming out of Iowa was about what is the most important thing to you? And the Iowa voters who said nominating a true conservative was the most important thing to them. Only 1% of them voted for Romney, and almost all of them voted for Rick Santorum. And I thought that was interesting because, one, Rick is not a kind of orthodox movement conservative, but he has the rhetorical style,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of takes, and I think most importantly, he's disliked by liberals in the media,
yes.
And takes sort of the punches for it. And I think that is taken as the sign of being a true conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most voters don't, they don't run down the issue list, especially, especially on, say, the free market side of conservatism. And they don't run down that issue list and think, that's how I'm going to determine who is the conservative in the race. Mm-hmm. I think they kind of actually look to the media to signal to them who the real conservative is. Mm-hmm.
For the media to signal, you mean by the media to show contempt for a particular conservative candidate, and therefore signifying him as the him or her as the most conservative.
Right, and then also for the other conservative movement organs like talk radio or these blogs online to then complain about that media treatment.
Right.
It's a very roundabout way of signaling. I'm not sure what that means. I mean, I'm not sure if there's anything analogous to this on the liberal side at all. When looking for who would most represent our interests. I mean, I don't see that signaling on the left. Maybe I'm just not looking hard enough.
Well, there's definitely a kind of signaling. I just think it's very different. It's not, I'm not sure that it's as reactionary, but if you remember back to like the Clinton-Obama primary, there were certain sort of cultural signifier or cultural or ideological signifiers that came into play about who was really, who was really going to, represent liberal interests. And if you remember, the one thing that I can think of that was really like that was Obama saying that he wanted to be transformative like Reagan, and this turned into a thing of whether or not Obama thought Reagan was an awesome president, and therefore was not, was secretly a conservative. That's the one thing I can think of that is sort of similar in terms of, like, an issue of that is maybe more symbolic than substantive that sort of took, everybody was paying attention to during the last Democratic primary.
Yeah. I mean, Santorum's rise, it was interesting too, because I felt like some people were saying that the, it was all about timing. Mm-hmm. And I think timing was important because Gingrich rose and started to actually, he became this first non-Mitt Romney candidate to actually begin eating into Mitt Romney's poll numbers.
Right. If Gingrich had like risen, a couple of weeks later, I'm not sure that. I mean, Gingrich might have won Iowa instead of Romney.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also, the negative ads absolutely seem to work. Mm. I mean, Dave Weigel did some great reporting about how literally voters in Iowa began repeating the language of the ads. Saying, "Oh, well, Newt Gingrich has a lot of baggage, and I'm worried about that." My controversial position is that for this, I'm actually very grateful for Citizens United because negative ads tend to be truthful, tend to have good content, and we're going to see more of them now when candidates don't have to sign their name to them.
So here's what I think about Santorum. I mean, aside from the fact that I think the structural factors are going to doom Santorum anyway, yeah. I think, Santorum, there's a couple of things that, are going to take the bloom off the rose when it comes to Santorum. And one of them is that, he was a senator during, the profligate Bush years when, conservatism or at least the conservatism today says that during the 8 years of the Bush administration, conservatism went astray. It became big government conservatism. And Santorum was a huge part of that.
Yeah.
And as far as the Tea Party movement is concerned with sort of special interests and undue influence, I mean, Rick Santorum was smack in the middle of the K Street Project, holding meetings and totally sort of, he was a huge part of trying to align the whole lobbying industry with the interests of the Republican Party. And I think, in general, he's also a senator from a pretty blue state and is probably going to have a few votes that he's going to have to explain as well, although I can't think of any off the top of my head. But I suspect that Santorum is going to turn out to have a fairly broad number of heresies he's going to have to explain if he continue. That is, if he's not sort of knocked out fairly quickly.
Yeah, I mean, he voted for Medicare Part D.
Right.
Although Paul Ryan whipped votes for that and helped to really pass it in the House. And
sure.
He still gets a lot of credit that for purity that maybe isn't deserved. But no, I think all that's true, and I do think those things would doom Santorum, and I think if Santorum was the one that rose when Newt Gingrich did, mm-hmm. there would be a ton of negative ads about Santorum.
Right.
I don't even know if Romney's going to have to do that, because despite the fact that Santorum raised $1 million yesterday, it's too late for him to buy ads in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And I think he's not going to be able to make a run in New Hampshire. And then by that time, you know, Rick Perry and Newt Gingrich are going to try to run down to South Carolina for their last stands. And, you know, the conservative vote, once again, you know, the kind of movement conservative vote will be split among mm-hmm. more than one candidate. And Romney, I think, is going to sail through without ever having to win a huge percentage of the vote before he knocks everyone out.
Mm. Well, so something that's interesting about Santorum, and I think a lot of Democrats noticed this watching his speech, his Iowa speech, was he was sort of very, you know, his speech focused a lot on his working class grandfather. And there was a lot of sort of very deliberate class messaging in his Iowa speech, which I think was sort of an attempt to draw a contrast between him and Romney, mm-hmm. You know, who obviously Democrats are trying really hard to paint as the Wall Street guy. But a Republican friend of mine actually sent me an op-ed from 2006. That David Brooks had written about how liberals shouldn't be so mean to Santorum over his social conservatism, because religious conservatives are sort of the kind of conservatives who might be persuaded to go along with some of the big government things that liberals want to do. And as opposed to libertarians who are sort of philosophically opposed to the idea of government intervening even in a positive way, because it never turns out that way. There are, you know, people like George W. Bush, for example, who can be motivated under certain circumstances to try to use government to help people who are not wealthy, working class people. And I thought that was actually kind of interesting, especially given Santorum's speech and his autobiography, which I guess was like mostly ghostwritten. There's a review that I think we both read that was written by my former boss, Mark Schmidt, right. at the American Prospect, and we both, had a similar reaction to it, but why don't you go ahead and say what you thought?
Well, it was interesting. Mark Schmidt wrote a review of Rick Santorum's book, It Takes a Family, which obviously plays off of Hillary Clinton's 1990s book, It Takes a Village. And, you know, the book was published by ISI, which is sort of this academic conservative book publisher, and it was ghostwritten by Mark Henry, who's kind of a brilliant guy over there. But it definitely, it sort of reframes conservatism or Rick Santorum's conservatism in such a way that it privileges family life and social values above free market purity and sort of tries to explain how maybe the government or the federal government can be used as a support for those, you know, traditionalist views. And it didn't get a lot of reaction at the time. What was interesting to me, though, is Schmidt summed it up as saying that, in essence, Rick Santorum had invented a intolerant, noxious liberalism instead of reinventing conservatism.
Yeah, he said he's invented a mean-spirited liberalism.
Right.
But it was like, it's sort of a devastating conclusion for, you know, a review of a Republican's book, right, which is Mark Schmidt saying you're essentially just a really nasty liberal.
It's the exact opposite of...
Which is what Ron Paul was actually saying in Iowa. And like must have sounded really weird to liberals to hear Ron Paul saying, oh, you know, Rick Santorum, he's just a big liberal. But like, you know, in some sense, like having read Mark Schmidt's review, I actually sort of understand where Ron Paul's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's sort of there was this, you know, maybe there was this little strain in politics that got lost in the way realignment happened in the 80s and 90s. But there was a strain of, you know, maybe Bob Casey style, Rick Santorum style politics that sort of never found a home in either party. And, you know, most parties, I think, have had the disciplining effect on people's minds, either to scrub the social traditionalism out of some people in the liberal coalition and to scrub the, you know, big government approach in the conservative coalition. And so, you know, you're just left with these quixotic figures. But it's not something that is alien to, you know, this is something that's come up again and again in Iowa during the primaries, which is that, you know, 1988, Pat Robertson, who was a trade protectionist and talked about manufacturing and needing to maintain it, he came in a strong second in Iowa. In 1996, Pat Buchanan, or 92, he did pretty well in Iowa, and it set him up for a win in New Hampshire, and he won New Hampshire in 96. Preaching the same, you know, it was a slightly different cast than Santorum has on it, but it was the same idea that, you know, America needs a manufacturing base in order to provide stable, family-sized salaries to working men. And Mike Huckabee actually came along with some of this 4 years ago. So it's a recurring strain, and, you know, Jonathan Chait has often said that, you know, the majority of Americans tend to be at least somewhat social traditionalists, and they tend to be somewhat economically liberal. But the coalitions in our politics don't, you know, ask people to choose between that.
And well, I'm the not Democratic sure Party, hold... I think, was that, like, you know, 80 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's sort of how we got the New Deal and everything else. But I mean,
right, like, which had a lot of paternalistic, family-oriented sides to it. In fact, there's a book, I mentioned ISI, but I think Alan Carson wrote a book about the New Deal and how pro-family it was compared to modern liberalism, or, you know, how patriarchal, you know, however you want to frame it. But it's kind of this lost element of our politics, and, you know, I think it's going to remain just this little curio because it doesn't have any kind of institutional support within the political sphere.
See, you know what I think, though, is... And this is my theory on why we'll probably never have, like, a libertarian president, is that anybody who, like, wants to run for to be president of the United States, who wants to run the American government, wants to do something with it. You know, so I think, like, I think it's almost inevitable that you know, on the Republican side, particularly among the kind of people who, you know, are running for the White House, this sort of tendency to want to go in there and do something other than simply dismantle or alter the sort of the programs like Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid, they're going to actually want to do something new with all this government power that they have. And so it's just, I'm not sure that you can ever really banish big government conservatism, even though you may not be able to speak its name when you're in the process of selecting a candidate for president.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's right. I mean, and it's true too that, you know, sort of that libertarian strain would be more popular among intellectuals and journalists than it would be among politicians. I mean, the whole nature of politics is seeking power, and people that tend to seek power, as you're right, want to do something with it. You know, Santorum, it's funny, I'm very sympathetic to kind of his social conservatism and to his, although not necessarily the style he brings to it, and then also to some of his economic populism. You know, for me, the killer is his foreign policy, which is brings that same kind of moralism out into international affairs, and you know, I think it's he's also talked a lot about foreign policy. I mean, that's part of what he focused his post Senate career on, was talking about the threat of Latin American socialism, of Russia, of an Islamic caliphate. And, you know, that's not gotten a lot of attention because presidential elections, remarkably, even though the president has a lot more influence on foreign policy than domestic policy, for some reason presidential elections are never about foreign policy. Or almost never about them.
Well, almost never. Okay. 2004, I think, was, in particular, was an election that was very much about foreign policy.
Right.
But, or at least in terms of how, I'm not sure how much of an effect it had on the election. It certainly, I don't think it was more decisive than the economy, but it certainly was an election in which foreign policy was at the forefront of the public debate.
Well, what's funny about that was that I think in retrospect, you know, foreign policy really did mess up Democrats in that year because it made them so nervous about whom to choose for their representative. Meanwhile, Bush kind of just, you know, he was pre-committed on foreign policy and could focus on, you know, ballot amendments about ballot initiatives on same-sex marriage to use as a turnout device. But I mean, there was just such a psychodrama about Dean or General Wesley Clark, or we'll split the difference and pick someone who was once a war protester and a veteran. And then we'll try to figure out how to make both of those work together in one image for this election. And it just, it didn't work.
There's an amazing Tolles cartoon about the sort of military pageantry of the Democratic convention that year that I can't, it's impossible to describe, but even at the time I thought it was one of the funniest cartoons that I'd ever seen because it was so, the Democrats were so self-consciously trying to sort of contrast war hero Kerry with Chicken Hawk Bush. It was really over the top. And at the time, I'm not sure how many people understood how over the top it was.
Oh, no, it was, that's the thing, that's why I paused on it, because it seems so ridiculous in retrospect.
Right.
You know, John Kerry, I'm reporting for duty, and like.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But anyway, people haven't been talking about Santorum's foreign policy at all. I mean,
I actually find Santorum's foreign policy pretty frightening, just in the sense that he has his religious conservatism translates into a religious nationalism that I think is sort of that I think is actively harmful.
I agree,
particularly to fighting terrorism, because I mean part of what Al Qaeda really wants is to sort of, you know, portray this idea that the United States that the West and Islam are at war, and so you better go in with Al Qaeda because the West is going to destroy you, and they're the only ones who can save you. And when you start hearing Rick Santorum talking about how this is our destiny, I think, you know, a lot of conservatives really enjoyed the Lord of the Rings trilogy around the time it came out because they saw it as a metaphor for the war on terror. But I think Rick Santorum may be the only public figure who actively used Mordor as like a metaphor for Al Qaeda and terrorism in his public remarks.
There's this weird, you know, I'm a Catholic traditionalist, and there's this weird subgrouping of political Catholic traditionalists who have this kind of apocalyptic view of Islam, and you know they think of the gates of Vienna in the 16th century, or how Islam seemed at one point like it was about to conquer Europe in the late Middle Ages, and you know they quote a few passages of the early 20th century English writer Hilaire Belloc talking about how he believed Islam would rise again to challenge the West, and you know they say, look, you know he was prophetic, and we're in this time. You know, what they don't mention, though, is that Belloc thought that, you know, Islam could catch up technologically and do that. And, you know, we're not, you know, conservatives in America take on this baggage from the Cold War of kind of an ideological struggle for the whole planet, and they transmit it on to a group of terrorists who don't have ICBMs pointed at our heads. They're literally,
or even popular legitimacy. I mean,
these people are in caves, for God's sake, and we're terrified in Iowa about them. It just doesn't. It doesn't make sense to me yet.
Well, it's like you look at the people who really have a global agenda in terms of like Al Qaeda has a global agenda that they're pursuing through violence. But if you look at like the groups that are actually fairly popular in the Middle East, the terrorist groups that are very popular, it's Hamas and Hezbollah, and that's,
of course,
you know, for two reasons: because they have social service wings that Al Qaeda doesn't have, but also because they're focused on Israel, which everyone in the Middle East, regardless of religious background, tends to really hate. But there's sort of a way in which this opposition to Israel and this support for these groups that are opposed to Israel translates into the belief that the broader Middle East supports this project of establishing a caliphate and bringing Islam back to, you know, the way it was centuries ago. And I don't think that popular support for that kind of thing just really isn't there. I mean, and there's just a tendency, I think, to really overstate the degree to which ordinary Muslims support this kind of thing. And I think a lot of it has to do with vocabulary and things that are lost in translation.
Oh, but, absolutely.
But, you know, you look at, like, you know, it's sort of funny to me. It's like, I think Matt Iglesias said this. A lot of conservatives seem really surprised when the Muslim Brotherhood was winning elections in Egypt, and he said something along the lines of, "I always find it amusing when conservatives seem to be shocked that conservative religious nationalism is a winning pitch in elections in other countries."
It's funny too how this. In a way, the kind of pure dream of neoconservatism in the early part of the decade, that democratization would bring some kind of liberalization to the Middle East, is just being proven over and over again to be wrong. And, Santorum was even making noise about Russia's elections, which, you know, if the voting fraud went on the way that Santorum and others describe it, correcting it would mean bringing the communists into a greater share of the government than the United Russia Party under Putin. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, the ironies abound.
I think there's a certain truth to the problem. I think is Hussein Ibish, I think, discussed this really well, which is that the Arab world right now sort of gets Jefferson. They get the Jeffersonian side of democracy. They don't get the Madisonian side as well yet. And I think that's really important. But I think that happens over time. And I think in a dictatorship, when you don't have an open marketplace of ideas, and the only place that's sort of safe from that kind of ideological repression is the mosque, it makes sense that the people. That the religious conservatives are the ones who are able to turn out votes the first election after the despot is gone. But I think that, you know, there's this idea, you know, there's this idea that's central to Islamism, which is that, you know, it's the reason the regimes were so evil was because they were secular. And I think, like, when you have, you know, if you let these elections take place and the Islamists win and they have to govern and it doesn't work out so well, well, then, you know, they get thrown out. I mean, like, that idea that Islam is a guard against the sort of things that you saw in the old regime, it's factually untrue. I mean, nothing is a guard against, like, basic human moral frailty. But I think to get past that, you sort of have to let that discourse play out. You can't sort of keep it bottled up by supporting, whatever secular autocrat with enough guns to keep people online comes along.
That's well said. That's very well said. So what was interesting, too, taking this foreign policy view back to our domestic political section, was that it seemed like in Iowa, to hit one more Iowa point, one of the things that actually hurt Ron Paul was he was attacked on whether he would be as supportive of Israel and Israel's aspirations as the other candidates. Mm-hmm. And it's really funny. I've mentioned this before in writing and maybe even on Blogging Heads once, but it's really amazing how living in relative peace in, you know, on our continent, relative security and prosperity. People love to indulge in this kind of what George Orwell called transferred nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that Iowans look at Israel and try to actually identify with Israel. It's remarkably misguided as far as it's, and distorting as far as it works on American foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, it's like really amazing and endearing. And like, it would be cute if it didn't have such a distorting effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's 9/11 has hit, you know, everybody talks about sort of the Israel lobby or whatever, but I think the biggest impact on American perception of Israel, I think, is 9/11. And Bibi Netanyahu is really shrewd in saying our struggle against, you know, Hezbollah and Hamas is the same as your struggle against Al Qaeda, and that and this general sort of view of Islamist extremism as this all being one thing has sort of, I think that's what's really sort of made, I think American public opinion was a little more balanced prior, well, I think it was a lot more balanced prior to the 9/11 attacks, at which point, you know, the suspicion of Islam grew so much that, this sort of emotional identification with Israel became much, much stronger.
Yeah, absolutely. And, but it's interesting that it has such an actual effect on voting in Iowa, because I think, as you mentioned, people put a lot of emphasis on the Israel lobby, and that's all kind of inside D.C. stuff. And there's kind of almost been a myth that among people like myself, you know, anti-war conservatives, that somehow it's just this distorting lobby money in Washington, and not actually kind of the popular views of Americans that they've adopted, and in an actual voter, when you talk to them, it could be 9/11. It could be a little bit of what they hear on talk radio, and then a little admixture of Christian Zionism, which they might pick up, you know, once in a while at church or on religious radio. But it never seems to be just purely one or the other. It's always like just this admixture of influences. But it really does shake out in electoral results.
The other thing is if you're a liberal supporter of Israel, I mean, Santorum's views on the subject are really crazy. Because he seems to think that Israel should hold on to the West Bank and Gaza. You said that's Israel. It's just like, you know, it's just like when we got New Mexico and Texas, and it's like, you know, that's, I mean, from a demographic standpoint, the Jewish Israel as a Jewish state ceases to exist without some serious apartheid South Africa style measures. If Israel keeps the West Bank and Gaza, like the only way to sort of keep Israel both democratic and Jewish is to have a Palestinian state.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, I understand that Santorum's views on the subject are to a large degree probably informed by his religious views. But that's, you know, his sort of idea that the Palestinians don't. I mean, that's a really scary thing. It's a really scary thing, I think, for liberal Jewish supporters of Israel, because they recognize that that actually is not a sustainable framework going forward.
And not only that, but I mean, it's also, you know, there are ironies for conservatives and Christians in that by pushing this, anti-Palestinian state policy to the max and the rhetoric to the max, they're actually, they're polarizing that conflict in a way that's actually most detrimental to Palestinian Christians, who are seen as sort of half collaborators with Israel at sometimes, or and the fear is, of course, is that Palestinian Christians will be driven out of a Palestinian state as they have as Christians in Iraq are being driven out of Iraq, when there's a major conflict. And it's stunning in a way that American Christians, for all of the Crusader state rhetoric that they kind of transfer onto Israel,
there's almost no emotional identification with Arab Christians.
Yeah, or, I mean, sometimes even knowledge of it. I mean,
yeah.
You know, a few Christians still do tourism in the Holy Land and see some Palestinian Christians, but, I mean, it's just, you know, when I was at a Christians United for Israel conference, you know, a couple years ago, I asked someone about Palestinian Christians, and they basically said, oh, well, you know, they should just, you know, become Israelis, or, you know, that they could have
because
no...
Because that's an option.
Yeah, that they could have no legitimate interests apart from Israel's interest in the region. It's stunning. So we should circle back a little bit. I think we both secretly love talking about foreign policy. Yeah, not so secretly, and we both actually probably agree a lot more than is useful for a left-right dialogue. But, you know, my feeling going into this weekend, I'm heading up to New Hampshire tomorrow, is that Romney's nomination is almost inevitable.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's sort of becoming like, even though Bob Dole had to fight in South Carolina to get it, I feel like it's becoming like a Bob Dole style nomination where no one loves this candidate. They're just resigning themselves to it. I think the 1 in 1,000 chance is that a John Huntsman gets a Santorum like surge this week, because Huntsman has you know, one, a credible record as a governor in Utah. Incredibly more conservative than Romney's, and it's possible that he can raise as much or more money than Mitt Romney in the long term, you know.
Well, I think what, you know, what's fascinating about Huntsman is I think Huntsman is a perfect example of that sort of process that we were talking about earlier, where the media criticizes a candidate, talk radio and the conservative media intervene on to defend that candidate, and the result is that that candidate's conservative bona fides are bolstered in the eyes of the conservative electorate. Whereas, like, Huntsman, that process has never happened because he has this way of coming across like he's a lot more liberal than he is, and he's not liberal. I mean, he's a conservative,
yeah.
And it's just, like, his penchant for, like, using a certain tone or just, like, not affecting the necessary, like, verbal and cultural cues of contemporary conservatism has made everybody think he's some sort of, you know, total squish. That and the fact that he worked for, you know, he was Obama's ambassador to China.
Right, and it's funny because I've gotten tagged somewhat within conservative circles as, like, Huntsman's conservative apologist. And, you know, I went in when I wrote about him in the summer for the American Conservative, I went in thinking I might not like this guy, you know, at all. And what I found is I ended up really liking him because, one, he's a bit of a realist on foreign policy, and I would like to see that school grow along with the non-interventionist school. I think the Republican Party needs both of those lines of thought. And I liked that he had no affinity with the conservative movement's temperament. I actually felt like that was an asset. I think it might be an asset in the way that he's been able to govern in Utah, but it is not proving to be an asset at all electorally. It just doesn't seem to be in him. He's almost like a temperamental conservative, and I think he governed that way in Utah, and Utah has a very conservative legislature, and so he just worked with them for what looked like sensible things. And, you know, he happens to be pro-life and pro-gun rights. So he had that, but he just has no... it doesn't seem like he has a kind of ideological affinity. It doesn't seem like after this run, he would want to start spending time at CPAC and, like, meeting people within the movement. He seems just utterly self-possessed. And in a weird way, that self-possession has been the big liability in a sense, because conservatives look at him like, this is a guy we can't get our hooks into. Mm. So there you have it. But
I'm interested in here. Do you think that if we had another month, that Santorum would have gone down as the next not Romney, and people might have actually started looking at Huntsman as the other next not Romney?
Yeah.
And do you think that if he does a good, if he has a strong showing in New Hampshire, do you think that might still happen?
I think it could still happen. It just might be too late. Although, you know, South Carolina has always been this killer of insurgent candidates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone, I think James Antle over at the American Spectator might have put it this way, but people look at South Carolina and a lot of journalists think, oh, white religious evangelicals. Mm. But in fact, it's like a state that their political culture is extremely establishmentarian. They have tons of political consultants, like more than any other state. And somehow, you know, Bob Dole wins that state. John McCain kicks ass in that state.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a question last time whether Romney's totals were depressed because there's an anti-Mormon strain that sort of is within white evangelical voters, but then also maybe even within South Carolina's establishmentarian culture. So maybe that provides an opening for someone to make to become a real not Mitt Romney of the cycle, but. But yeah, I do think that Huntsman could have gotten that ride if there had been more time, you know, because elites started, you know, elites and activists started to look at him and say, oh, gee, look at this plan he released in the Wall Street Journal on taxes. It's really conservative. Oh, look at this plan. You know, look at the abortion laws he signed in Utah. They're really conservative. Mm-hmm. But, you know, electoral politics isn't about just the positions you take. It's also the pose you strike.
Yeah. You know, now that I think about it, I think, you know, when you were talking about whether liberals have anything similar, I think the truth is that liberals respond to that same signifying process the way that conservatives do. They just, I mean, they have a different response, but they totally... I think Huntsman is an example, now that I think about it, of liberals sort of doing the same thing and seeing Huntsman as perhaps less conservative for the same reasons that you're talking about, for the same reasons that conservatives have seen him as less conservative, even though, as you're pointing out, he has an extremely conservative record.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I think maybe it's because, you know, I've become really alienated from the conservative movement. Not that they ever wanted me, but I just don't like the personality of it, and just I'm not a match to it temperamentally. And I think a lot of people feel that way when they look at the conservative movement and conservative movement events, and it reminds them of, like, their most overbearing uncle at the Thanksgiving dinner table.
Right.
And you get the feeling, in a way, that a lot of liberals would not mind at all having John Huntsman eat Thanksgiving dinner with them.
Right.
Whereas if Santorum were to come over, it could get like really uncomfortable and annoying. So that's, I think that's definitely, you know, it's not like the beer, would you drink a beer with him test? It's like, would you be able to handle Thanksgiving dinner?
The Thanksgiving dinner candidate, yeah.
Yeah, and I think Huntsman for liberals would be the Republican that they'd have over for Thanksgiving dinner.
Right.
Because, you know, he might, if you really pressed him, he might mention that he's pro-life, but he's not going to, like, rant about sluts and being irresponsible or something like that.
The words man-on-dog sex are not going to happen at Thanksgiving dinner with John Huntsman.
No, unless he's just making a joke, you know, about someone else.
Right.
So, so yeah, and that maybe that's his problem. And conservatives, listen, are in the mood to spoil the dinner of everyone else in America. I mean, they're in a pugnacious mood.
Mm-hmm.
It, I guess my question would be going forward is whether this is a permanent condition of the right, whether this style is always going to be the case. You know, this, we're under siege. We, you know, we need to spoil everyone else's fun. I don't know. I mean, that's just sort of an open-ended question.
Yeah, I actually wouldn't know how to answer that either.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's good. I mean, I'm also, you know, I have huge problems with our political culture, the cronyism of Washington, some of the things even the Tea Party is railing against. I'm totally with them. But it seems like, you know, if given a choice between stopping a deal like Solyndra from happening in Washington and finding something that would further humiliate and embarrass Keith Olbermann, you know, the average ideological conservative would go for the Olbermann embarrassment over good government every single time.
Well, see, now you're really not going to get invited to any of the CPAC parties.
Right. I guess I'm not. But, but yeah, I mean, conservatives sort of are like, are locked in this mode of sort of expressive, almost 60s style politics of like, well, we just want to express ourselves and piss everyone off and throw a happening and then, you know, see what we get out of it.
You know, I think the sustainability of that, you know, just having thought about it over the past few minutes since you brought it up, I think the sustainability of that may have something to do, as politics may have something to do with how well the economy does. I think, you know, if we start heading towards a really serious recovery, I mean, I just think right now, I think that works a lot because people are genuinely angry. I mean, it's not just conservatives who are in the mood to spoil someone's dinner. I mean, there's a substantial number of people who have been without work for a really long time and are justifiably angry about it.
Yeah.
But I wonder if the country does get back on track and we're not stuck in this place of 8 to 9% unemployment and things start getting better, I wonder how much that kind of politics is going to be sustainable even within the conservative movement, and whether or not it's going to, you know, I'm sure it's going to be permanent, but I don't know how much it's going to be, you know, the dominant tone.
No, that's true. I mean, in one way, though, this kind of politics emerged most especially in the 90s when things were going well. I mean, David Brooks kind of made his bones talking about how all of these rich Republicans in the suburbs of Chicago, you know, were wondering what the hell everyone is so angry about, that they would want to vote for Pat Buchanan. Mm-hmm. So maybe it is kind of a built-in feature. I think it's also just a function of the fact that, especially for certain kinds of religious conservatives, and for ideological conservatives, I think they understand intuitively that the future does not belong to them. Mm-hmm. You know, demographically, culturally, they're on the losing side.
Well, certainly when it comes to gay marriage.
Yeah, no, exactly. But also, I mean, the gains in, say, the abortion debate have not been as dramatic as, say, the reversals on the marriage issue.
Sure. But I think, you know, I think I actually think, though, that the anti-abortion movement has done substantially well, particularly when it comes to the judiciary. I mean, maybe you don't have like a popular majority for banning birth control or whatever, but you certainly, the liberals have not paid a whole lot of attention to the importance of of filling the judiciary with judges who share their legal philosophies, and
right.
Particularly this president has been bad at filling the vacancies and at banging the table and trying to get those judges through. And I think the result is that you have, but conversely, conservatives have done a really good job of getting judges who are ready to uphold restrictions on abortion and interpret, women's right to choose whether or not they carry a pregnancy to term fairly narrowly. And it's almost like, it's one of those things that we have yet, there's yet to be like a liberal Roe v. Wade in the sense that there's yet to be, even you would have thought it was Bush v. Gore, but there's yet to be like a case a legal case that really sort of galvanizes the liberal legal movement into being as aggressive at changing the judiciary as Roe v. Wade has been for the anti-abortion movement. And that side of it certainly has been very successful.
That's true. And you know, abortions, even as the population of the United States goes up, the raw number of abortions has been trending downward for a while now. Of course, some people say that partially that number is trending down because of abortion's availability and the way that it breaks a cycle that's pretty dangerous for people. But that's actually too radical a thought for me to contemplate in the last few minutes here. Well, listen, this has been a lot of fun. I think we should wrap
great.
It up.
It's great talking to you, and I'm looking forward to doing it again.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll be engaged in the conversation after New Hampshire sometime.
Yeah, of course. All right, take care, Michael.
Take care. You too.